And good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is Bierman versus Benjamin, and I believe this is the BD case. First of all, so Mr. Holbrook, good morning to you.
Please the court, counsel. My name is Brad Holbrook, and I, along with co-counsel Mr. Norton, we represent the defendant and appellants in these cases, those parties being Brenda Benjamin individually and as personal representative of the estate of her late husband, Mark W. Benjamin, who passed away on April 14, 2015, along with BD Construction, Inc. Kearney. Although we've raised multiple appeals issues in our brief, I'd like to talk about three issues today, those issues being: one, whether the trial court erred in granting summary judgment, finding that the September 29, 2009 buy-sell agreement was enforceable in the event of death, when paragraph 5.2 of the buy-sell agreement specifically stated in all other operative events other than the death of the shareholder. The second issue is that relating to the breach of fiduciary duties that related to whether or not Ms. Benjamin, as the only one in charge of BD Construction, breached any duty by issuing bonuses in 2016. And the third issue is a valuation issue as it relates to the trial court finding in its June of 2018 order that the valuation of Mr. Benjamin's controlling 59% interest in BD would be the date of his death pursuant to the buy-sell agreement, and that the $2 million in life insurance on his life would be excluded, neither of which were touched upon in the buy-sell agreement, and neither of which were supported in law or fact. It is the appellant's position that the court erred in all three respects. Discussing first the buy-sell agreement, it has always been the appellant's contention from the inception of this lawsuit and even pre-lawsuit that this buy-sell agreement is unambiguously unenforceable as against the estate in the event of death. It's unenforceable because there's no pricing mechanism. If you look at the buy-sell agreement, Article 5, and I believe all parties as well as the court agreed, was the only article that dealt with what's price. Appellants raised that issue pre-suit, and it wasn't only the appellants that had an issue or concern about the pricing mechanism, but it was the appellees as well. Pre-suit, Mr. George issued a letter, I believe that it's Exhibit 125, where he indicated, we've got a problem here. There must be some type of Scrivener's error, because we can't locate a pricing mechanism either. During the lawsuit, the trial court, in one of its early orders, on one of the many opportunities that the appellees took to try to remove my client as an officer and director, also noted the absence of a pricing provision, and that was in its TRO order, I believe, of November 16.
So is your argument that the agreement is ambiguous?
No.
No.
The argument is that it is unambiguously unenforceable in the event of death. There's a severability clause in the buy-sell agreement, and while the buy-sell may be enforceable in all other respects, it is unenforceable in the event of death because there's no pricing mechanism. An essential term of contract that is required in all contracts doesn't exist.
So you're saying there was no agreement here at all?
No, there is a buy-sell that is enforceable, except it's unenforceable in the event of death. So all other operative events, other than death, we have pricing mechanisms.
So where does that leave you and us and everyone else?
Well, where that leaves us is that another operative event occurred during these proceedings, and that was the termination of the employment of Mr. Hoppenstedt and Mr. Bierman. And that is also an operative event that triggers the provisions of the buy-sell. The evidence came in at trial that my client elected to go ahead and purchase their interest and issued a disposition notice along with their termination, which was April 20th, 2016. So while the agreement is enforceable because of that operative event, because we do have a pricing provision, it is 5.2, it is unenforceable as against the estate in the event of death because we do not have a pricing provision in that circumstance.
Relying on the language of 5.2. Other than death.
There's no other language to look to. It is clear. Pricing is Section 5. You can't find it anywhere else. Article 3 talks about pricing in Section 5 and buyout is Section 6. You can't, the court, again, early on noted, but I've got to find some pricing mechanism, otherwise it would eviscerate the entirety of the document and would defeat the intent of the parties. The problem is he didn't look past the document to make his ruling. If the court had looked at additional evidence, even the drafter of this document, the exhibit was Deposition Exhibit 22, which was received at summary judgment, and his notes that we
How do you get to the drafter of the document unless the document is ambiguous?
Well, you wouldn't. If the document is, in fact, unambiguous, you cannot look at any extrinsic evidence. The problem is the court took a document and said, this is unambiguous, and I'm going to look only to this document. But the court itself had to come up with some strained reason to say the other than language only applies to qualify who the buyer is. We don't need that. Article 3 says who the buyer is. It's the corporation, and if it legally can't, then it's the shareholders. Article 5, the very sentence that the court construed, says, in all other operative events other than the death, the corporation and or the shareholders shall. So we already have the identity of the buyer in there.
Do you think this is an error of law by the trial court?
Absolutely, it's an error of law. It's an error of law. It's an error of fact. The only ruling that this court could have held on summary judgment was there is no pricing mechanism. It is invalid, unenforceable in the event of death. That's the only finding that could be supported in any set of circumstances. Now, if the document is ambiguous and we have to look beyond that, the evidence that the court ignored would further support the same finding. The drafter of this document, who didn't have much experience, borrowed a form from a law firm that he respected, didn't have much experience with this form either, had conversations with Mr. George during this case that is in Mr. George's billings, which are Exhibit 148. He was concerned about malpractice. He couldn't recall why he put it in there other than he put other than in other times in this document. There's 11 versions. It doesn't appear anywhere else. He has notes that say price on death, question mark. He has notes, determined price, how. Different in the event of death versus voluntary unemployment. Check confusing language on death and other operative events.
Suppose, let's say we think there's an issue of fact. We're not prepared, I'm just saying this hypothetically, we're not prepared to sign off with you that it's unambiguously unenforceable. But there's an issue of fact about what the proper interpretation is. And given that this came about on summary judgment, you know, we can't decide issues of fact on summary judgment. Where does that take us?
Well, if there's an issue of fact, it still requires a reversal and remand to have a full evidentiary trial on this issue. Because, again, the court on its own, when all other parties stated, we've got an issue here, even if you look at the plaintiff's or the appellee's pleadings, they pled this of don't enforce the agreement. Enforce the agreement we reached in March where we settled on price. So they brought this case to the court saying don't worry about price because we have price figured out. That's incorrect, mind you. But if we have if we're left with the issue of fact is what does this mean, then we have to send it back down and have a full evidentiary hearing so that the court can hear all of this evidence on this issue. The second issue I'd like to talk about is
Let me also ask you, is do you agree that we're here in equity and this the standard of review is de novo?
The standard is de novo, and I would agree that we are here in equity because of the way it was pled.
And does that have any effect on how we might be able to resolve or not resolve the dispute with respect to the issue of the reformation or enforceability of the agreement?
Well, the problem is that how we got here was a matter of law, and that's the difficult. The case was brought as an equity. I think I heard that term about 1,000 times in this case. But really, the decision was made one of law. And so that's the difficult, which would be the easiest reason to send this thing back, because if my client is to receive every inference of law and fact, the court should have never granted summary judgment, and it should be sent back. I'd like to reserve the rest of the time if I can.
You may.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Swoboda, good morning to you.
Good morning, Chief. Justices, may it please the court. My name is John Swoboda, and I represent, along with Ken George, Doug Meerman, and Jim Hoppenstead. And I want to talk about those issues that were just raised as it relates to the enforceability of this agreement. We did file a motion for partial summary judgment to ask the court to deem the court wasn't, that the buy-sell agreement was enforceable. And I think you can look to the other provisions of this document. You have to look at the document as a whole to determine whether or not price is in there. Because in 5.2, it's missing. But if you look at a couple of other places, you can find it, okay? And that's what's missing from the argument of the appellant. If you look first at provision number 4.1, you can see where the corporation is going to buy life insurance for each of the shareholders at a price of, or at an amount that is consistent with the reasonable fair market value of that shareholder's shares, okay? That would assume a price, right? If we're going to buy insurance on that shareholder for the reasonable fair market value of that stock, isn't that what we would be talking about when we're purchasing on the death of a shareholder? And death is a mandatory event. In fact, you can also look at the recitals, particularly number 3 and 4, to determine that the parties intended on the death of a shareholder that the BD management and ownership, that there be some continuity to that, and that the spouse of a deceased shareholder not take over the corporation. How prophetic is that? We have to look to this and these other provisions to determine that intent.
Well, I think you're trying to tell us this, but how do we get past the sentence that says, except on death?
Right. And that's part of our claim at the partial summary judgment stage. The court did not get to our claim that it be reformed because of the Scrivener's error. There is clearly a Scrivener's error on this, but the court never got to that. And to answer Justice Castle's question, I think that that court, because it didn't get there, I think that court, even though you're hearing this inequity, I think that court gets to call the ball and strike on that. But I don't think you have to get there. I think if you look at that 4.1 and then you look at 6.3, where the corporation is, there's provisions about how the corporation's going to buy. If the life insurance isn't enough, that it's going to be entitled to make payments on that from the date of death. There's been an issue about when do we value the corporation. Well, right there is when you value the corporation. It says if the corporation, if there's not
Let's do a hypothetical. What if this court decided that the contract was ambiguous? Where does that put everybody?
Well, I'm not sure that any of the parties claimed that it was unambiguous. Now, I suppose you could find that as plain error. But that wasn't one of the things that was raised and argued, and I don't think it's been assigned or argued on appeal.
I think you just said that none of the parties said it was unambiguous, but I think you meant ambiguous.
You're correct, and thank you for correcting me on that. That's true. And so that was not, I don't believe, assigned or argued in any of the briefs.
If this court concludes that the agreement could be reasonably interpreted to have a pricing term or not have a pricing term, where would that leave us?
Well, I think in that regard, then you affirm, because maybe you affirm for a different reason than the district court found the pricing mechanism.
What would that different reason be?
Well, the provisions that I have cited, 4.1, 6.3, the second half of 5.2.
I'm asking you to assume that we find the agreement could reasonably interpreted the way you're suggesting, or reasonably be interpreted to be missing a pricing term.
Well, you also have to look, I think if you look at the at those provisions, I think you can determine that the price was a reasonable one. And I will say We did have an error in our brief. We had a misquote on the Amger. But that Amger section was cited for the proposition that a court can imply a reasonable price if that's the only thing that's missing. But again, I think if you go to those other sections where it talks about fair market value, that is the price.
But the threshold question is, are you engaging in determining a threshold or a price if there is no pricing mechanism?
If you look at at how the parties conducted themselves following Mr. Benjamin's death, Mrs. Benjamin had no problem determining a price, setting terms, and making an agreement by March 29, 2016. In fact, there's a written agreement in emails with her negotiator and Mr. Bierman coming up with the price.
So what is the legal significance of how the parties treated the substance of the contract, if any?
I think it goes to the idea that it was the fair market value, and that's what was determined by both of the experts for the parties in the case.
So you're going back to 4.1, 4.1.
4.1, 6.3.
Right.
The second half of 5.2 talks about right. If we can't agree on a price, we'll have a third-party appraiser. That's in 5.2. So I think all those provisions you have to look at to determine that intent.
So is it just an internal inconsistency?
I would say it is, okay?
But an internal inconsistency that doesn't render it ambiguous?
Right, because there's not two possible interpretations when we have fair market value. There's nothing else in there that talks about fair market value as it relates to death. We've purchased insurance, we've got a mandatory death sale, and we're getting insurance for the reasonable fair market value of that shareholder's shares.
And 4.1, life insurance is proximate to the expression fair market value.
Say that again?
In 4.1, life insurance, the words life insurance are near the language of fair market value.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right. Reasonable. It says reasonable fair market value.
But to return to Justice Papik's question, if it is ambiguous, summary judgment can't stand, can it?
Again, I have to go back and...
I know you want to argue.
That wasn't part of the argument.
It's not ambiguous.
Right.
But if we decide otherwise...
If you were to determine it was ambiguous, there would have to be extrinsic evidence which would be received by the court, and that would be a fact issue, so you are correct.
All right.
So, but again, I look back to those provisions, and I also want to address some of the fiduciary duty issues, if I may, unless there's further questions on the intent. There's a number of situations that occur.
What is our standard of review on the fiduciary duties issues?
Well, again, those, I believe, are equitable issues that...
So it's de novo.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what happened, an agreement was made on BD, but no agreement could be made on the Sixth Street entities, which comes up next. And so Mrs. Benjamin pulled out of the BD agreement. She terminated Mr. Hoppenstedt and Mr. Bierman, and then she was the only one in control of the corporation. She's the only director of a corporation whose bylaws requires three. So she made all the decisions, particularly to authorize $1,175,000 worth of bonuses in the same year that our clients were terminated. $535,000 of that went into her own pocket, over and above the $150,000 salary that she was paying herself. In addition,
how did that compare to bonuses that were given in previous years, and were your clients ever part of the process of giving bonuses in previous years?
Our clients were always consulted in that bonus process. The bonuses that were authorized in 2016 were more than the 9 years prior combined. They were exponentially larger. And most of it, again, went into Mrs. Benjamin's pocket. They want to hide behind the business judgment rule on this. Well, the business judgment rule doesn't protect them or her because she's interested in the transaction. That's one of the requirements of the business judgment rule, that you not be interested in the transaction. There are also repairs authorized to an airplane that was half owned by the corporation. She paid for half of, or she paid for the entire amount of the repairs, $92,000, when half of the plane was owned by her father-in-law. Then there's also
She conceded that
she did, but only on the right prior to trial.
But the big issue here is bonuses.
Yeah.
What if we're reviewing this de novo? What all does this court get to take into consideration?
I think you have to look at specific performance, and if you look at specific performance on the date at or about the March 29, 2016 timeframe, there was an agreement. If the transaction closes shortly after that, none of those bonuses are paid out. None of the $1,175,000 is paid out. And I think you have to put BD in the same position that it would have been had the transaction been cleared. So we're asking for the whole amount. And I see that I've run out of time, but if there's any further questions that I can answer.
I do have a question about the life insurance. That evaluation, the valuations disputed, one put it in and one did not put it in. What's the justification for leaving it out? Is it an asset of the corporation?
Mr. Best, the appellant's expert, included it, but he failed to include the corresponding liability. The life insurance was purchased specifically to buy out the share, and it was owned by the corporation. And if you look, and I think it's either 4.1 or 6.3 where it says, if the insurance is more than the value of that person's shares, the corporation gets to keep the insurance. In that situation, that part of it would be included, right? But their expert did not include the corresponding liability, and that had to be included.
But is there a liability if, in fact, the corporation gets back the shares?
There's the asset, the life insurance. Mm-hmm. There's the liability to pay them back. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I answered that question, but...
But in return for that liability, the money to pay out, you get shares back.
Yes.
So is it really a liability?
It is, because it's a payment. It's money that's going out of the corporation. The shares of stock will be retired. They will not have that value that they had prior to being purchased back by the corporation.
What is your authority for that?
Well, if the corporation buys back the stock, that means the only remaining shares issued.
Surely the corporation got some value.
They did. They
represented by the shares.
That's right, but those shares don't have the value that they had when they were owned by an individual.
Are you arguing that they're retired by the corporation?
They would be.
So then the total outstanding shares would just be the remaining shares.
That's exactly right. And the value of the corporation would be that which is owned by the remaining shareholders. Their relative shares would increase, because there's no longer that shareholder. Okay.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 37 seconds.
37 seconds, Mr. Holbrook.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just listening to the panel ask about the pricing mechanism is the issue that we have. The court had to guess, what's the dated value and do I include life insurance or not? The buy-sell was silent. There was no authority on what to do presented by the appellees.
The parties could agree if the proper interpretation is a reasonable fair value. That's enforceable, right?
Say that again, Your Honor.
The parties in their agreement could choose reasonable fair market value. They don't have to.
As the pricing mechanism?
Yes.
Sure, the parties can agree to do whatever they want.
Your argument is they didn't do that.
They didn't do that. They didn't do anything.
Okay.
They didn't do anything.
I beg your pardon. Were you speaking only about life insurance in 4.1 or in general when you're talking?
I thought Justice Castle was talking about price.
Okay.
But on any provision, the parties could agree to whatever they wanted to do. The problem is that they didn't do it in a lot of respects. They didn't do it on the evaluation, on whether to include life insurance or not. As a practitioner, I routinely am dealing with that issue. Is it in or is it out? And I put it in the document. This document is silent. They could have done it. They didn't do it.
Could you respond to the argument that Section 4.1, we can infer from Section 4.1 and the life insurance provision that the pricing mechanism was reasonable fair market value?
That it would be tied to the life insurance?
I understood opposing counsel to argue that we can infer from a pricing mechanism from the Section 4.1 provision on life insurance, and I'd like you to respond to that argument.
No, we can't, and the realities of the situation show that we can't. The life insurance was procured in 2002 and updated in 07. The buy-sell was signed in 09. There's no inference there because it predated it. And the life insurance also, you have to go to the payment section of Article 6 that states if there's enough life insurance, they get all the life insurance, and excess stays with the corporation. If there's not, then they get the life insurance, and you got a secured note with the shares for the remainder. That's not inferring price. That's one is talking about can I have insurance or not insurance, and the other is talking about how do I pay. If we had the situation where we had no life insurance, so Article 4 still sits there, and so you can have life insurance, and the parties can update it if they so choose. Where are we at then? If these policies had lapsed. Again, this predated the buy-sell even existing. It didn't even exist. So you can't infer that was a pricing mechanism because they're completely unrelated. It's merely happenstance that the life insurance was still in place at the time of death. But for that, we'd be in the same boat, which is show me where the pricing mechanism is. And the court, again, had to, because it did what it did on the summary judgment, it had to infer a date of death as a valuation, which in a later order, it conflicted itself and said, I didn't have much guidance on when to even value this thing and whether I put it in or I don't. So I see I'm way past time unless there's any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the second case of the day, also captioned as Benjamin versus Bierman. And that involves other properties, but basically same folks.